Microphone's not set too loud. Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to move on from our sort of introduction and start diving a bit into parts of C that maybe you didn't talk about quite enough in 2150, and then later on into assembly. But first, some logistics stuff. So one thing is about, I mentioned we had quizzes. So quizzes are online. They look like, you'll have a web page that looks like this. And they have an open and close date and a time limit. When you start a quiz, you have the amount of time specified in the time limit, which is normally going to be 90 minutes. So if you start a quiz, close it, walk away, and come back in 2 hours, you can't do it anymore. So please don't do that. We've hopefully made it more obvious when you do so that happened. After the closing date, the quiz will be graded. So you'll be able to see your answers, whether they were correct, the percentage of the class which got it right. This is sort of a testing installation, so I'm the only person who took it. And see that immediately afterwards. And so when you do a quiz, you'll get a confirmation because it starts the time limit, and you fill in the answers. You can change your answers anytime within the time limit. And the box should turn green. That means your answer is recorded. There's no submit button. Immediately when you press something and the box is green, your answer is recorded. If it's yellow, something's wrong. And if that keeps happening, let us know. We'll look at it and deal with it. So any questions about this? Yes. So these are open book, open notes. Just don't, like, I ask people for answers, write form posts asking for answers. Please do it alone. Oh, sorry. It's not the right, that button is broken in this testing installation. And as you can see, you can go back to it. And so quizzes are, I have, going to be, there's two a week. So there's one which will be released Thursday night. I have the time is listed as 7 p.m. This is so I have time after the last lecture, which ends at 4:45, to fix it if I don't get to something. And is due by the end of day Saturday. So you can take it anytime within that range. And there's a pre-quiz, which is on the readings listed on the schedule for the entire week, not just for Tuesday. And is released on Saturday and due Tuesday morning, 15 minutes before this class. There's a space for comments on the quiz, and we will actually have someone read those. And if the comment suggests that even though you selected the wrong answer, you knew what was going on, we may give you credit. If the comment suggests even though you selected the right answer, you didn't know what was going on, we may deduct credit. And the question order is randomized. So this means please do not refer to answer letters or the first answer in comments. We don't know what that is without doing a whole lot of work because it's different for every student. So any questions on quizzes in general? Yes. So the first quiz is released tonight and needs to be done before Saturday. Yes.
Is that on the book reading, or like how long do we have to get?
So the post quizzes are all on lecture material.
Okay.
The pre quizzes are on the book reading. And the book reading for next week, I will give you a note. So it's on x86 assembly. So theoretically, you know this from 2150 without reading. And if you want to do it that way, you can. Our book uses AT&T syntax assembly, which is the other syntax which may have been mentioned once in 2150. Versus Intel syntax, which is what you're used to. There's some important differences. Our book briefly describes them at the end of section 3.3. I don't think the description is very good, so I'm going to avoid all assembly syntax issues on the quiz. If I give you assembly snippets, I'll give them to you in both Intel and AT&T syntax. So you won't need to worry yet, and we'll go over next week what the differences are, hopefully in a way which is a bit clearer than what the book says. Yes?
Okay.
So the pre-quizzes are on the readings. So if you can't get a textbook by next Monday, we should talk. We can probably do something about it, but you should eventually get one. Can't get or borrow a textbook. Yeah?
I'm planning on putting an order to the store. That's not by a state, so that it hasn't been stocked yet.
I wasn't. This is usually the sort of thing they ask about in the spring. And it's not like the capacity of this course is a mystery in the normal enrollment. So I am puzzled that they don't have it. Well, if like a lot of people can't get it, I'll have to think about what to do about that. The purpose of the pre-quizzes is that it's really better if you've actually done some sort of preparation for lecture. Yeah.
I asked at the bookstore, and they said that they didn't have one on register for this course, so I don't think they have any copies. So I ordered one online, but I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
They had used ones really early on. There was a stack of five of them. And I mean, when I said early on, during the summer, they just never used to have.
Okay. Okay, that is weird. Okay, I don't know how that happened. Maybe I missed something. I did it for the spring, so I'm not sure what would be different. Okay, so that's something for me to look at. Okay, so other things, lab accounts should work now. If you register this week, you might not have a lab account yet for the class. We hopefully will fix that. And if you don't by late Friday, email me and we'll deal with it. If you have a lab account, you should have received an email with the account credentials. Okay, so slides and video and audio are on the course website, linked off the schedule. When I don't mess up the recording, which I did for the video for this section last time, sorry, but you have the other one. Also, there's anonymous feedback on Colab, and I do read it. All right. And office hours. So TA office hours for this class should start next week. All office hours are on the course website. My office hours are listed there. I don't quite know what they'll be on Fridays because I'm still working out when I have to meet with people. But they'll be posted on the website eventually. Yes?
Will TA office hours work with a queue?
So there will be a queue for some of the TA office hours, at least the ones in stacks. We might have some that are elsewhere where there won't be a queue. Usually, probably ones that aren't on Tuesday, which is usually the busiest day since things are due Wednesday. Other logistics questions in general? Yeah?
So besides the quizzes and the labs, what other homework do we have again?
Besides quizzes and labs?
Yeah.
So you have homeworks which are based on the lab that will be due after the lab. And do the before the next week's lab. So most labs have a homework associated with them. And these are all on the schedule. There's a little due above the next week's lab indicating there's a homework. Yes?
Is the lab portion due at the end of your lab time?
The question is, when are labs due? So labs, there's an electronic submission for them, and we will basically check that you have it done by about 10 p.m. of the lab day that you've submitted something. Because we won't distinguish between people in different labs. We think all the labs are doable in 75 minutes, and we hope to grade to give full credit for what any student should be able to do in 75 minutes. Yes?
So do we need people to lab for that?
You do not, I do not care if you go to lab or not. I would recommend it, but you don't have to. We also won't be checking that you go to your own lab, except that if a lab gets full, which we've never had happen, but maybe could, we'll turn that away people who aren't actually registered for that lab. And we have one in-lab quiz later in the semester we'll talk about when we get closer to that. Yes?
Is there any chance that the quizzes get open earlier, or is there a reason that they're
So the pre ones or the post ones?
More the post ones.
The reason I have them open as late as they do is that I want it to be after the last section, which is, ends at 4:45, and I want to have time if I don't get to something in that section to revise the quiz, so it doesn't cover material from lecture that we shouldn't. Okay, so on to actual course material. So last time we mentioned this idea that we have a processor, which is this logic circuit and some temporary storage. And we also have some external things like memory, and we also talked about I/O devices that are hooked up to it. So any questions about this idea before we move on? So we're gonna talk a bit about what's in memory. And the way we're gonna think about memory for this course is we're going to treat it as an array of bytes, that there's a bunch of 1-byte values, each of which has a unique index, and all the indexes are filled, and we can write it, sort of visualize memory like this. We have addresses and the byte that's stored at those addresses. And it doesn't actually, yeah. So it's an array of bytes, and the bytes have no intrinsic meaning. We don't know whether this is a number, or an instruction, or a floating point number. The way we know is how the CPU decides to access it. What reason does the CPU have for requesting that part of this array? That's the only way that these have this particular meaning. Okay. So it also doesn't matter which way I draw memory. Okay. So I sometimes might put high addresses at the top of a page or at the bottom. It's still the same thing. And related to that concept, we're going to have lots of cases where, even though this is an array of bytes, we want to get something bigger than a byte out of it. So for example, this is some C++ code for reading an integer on our machines, a 4-byte integer, from a particular place in memory. So that's these 4 bytes here. And we have to decide how to take these 4 bytes and interpret them as one bigger number than any of the individual bytes. And there are basically 2 choices. So one choice is we can decide that the byte with the lowest address goes in the least significant part of the number, that it affects the value the least. That's where we start building up the value, in a sense. And another option is that we can decide that the part with the lowest address is the most significant part of the number. And these are both valid options that real hardware uses. So the one where the least significant part of the number, the part which affects the value the least, is the lowest address, is called little endian. The one where the part with the lowest address affects the value the most is called big endian. In this class, we'll always be using little endian. So that's the rule you should expect. But in the real world, there's a mix of both. There's some hardware which will do big endian when you ask it to do this, some which will do little endian, or some which will do either, depending on how you ask it. So any questions about endianness? Yes?
Just to refresh, so little endian would mean basically correct?
The lowest number, yeah, is when you write it down as we would in English, in the rightmost part. Yes?
Method of code, like the int star x equals int star 0 equals 2000?
Yes.
How do you know that it goes from 42,000 up to 42,003?
This is a convention that all machines I know of follow. Is that when you specify an address of something bigger than a byte, you're specifying the address of the first byte, the address with the lowest number. Like, they wouldn't have to do that, but no one has thought it was a good idea to do otherwise. I guess I should remember to repeat these questions for the recording. But the question is, why is it why aren't we specifying the address of 42003? Any other questions about endianness? Okay, so this is sort of the abstract view of memory and how we access it. And memory has a particular way we use it by convention, not because the hardware says we have to, in typical programs we run. So in particular, here's the layout of memory on 64-bit Linux of a typical program. We have different parts of this array that we're using for different things. And you've hopefully heard of many of these things in 2150. Yes?
I just thought of a question from the last slide.
Okay.
Does C++ natively use little endian, or is that also dependent?
So the question is the endianness of C++ little? So that's a good question. And you'd think, you know, the language probably should define what something like this does. You know, that's C++ code, so obviously I just need to know how C++ works for that. And unfortunately, that's not how things work. C++ just does whatever the hardware does. So the behavior of this code in C++ will vary depending on what kind of machine you have. So on an x86 machine, it will work this way. If you have, say, a machine that runs PowerPC, it probably won't. Other questions written from this? We'll probably mention endianness again because it's a source of constant confusion when we get to other parts of this class. So as I was saying, we have that sort of abstract view of memory, and we have this convention about how we use it for programs. And we have these regions of memory that you probably saw in 2150 that we use for particular purposes. So we have the stack, where if you remember from 2150, this is where we store information for like recursive subroutines. That happens on the stack. You have the heap, where we do malloc and new. That's where those happen. And we have the program's actual data, like global variables and the actual machine code of the program. And you'll notice on this picture, we also have some holes. On Linux, part of these memory that is not for the program is used by the operating system in a way that you can't see from the program. And other parts of it just are unusable. You aren't allowed to use them. They aren't allocated for anything, but there's space that exists. And we'll talk later on in this semester about, you know, what's actually happening that we have these empty spaces in memory and how that actually happens in the hardware. Yes?
Could you distinguish real quick between what goes in the stack versus what goes in the heap?
So the question is, what's the difference between what goes in the stack and what goes in the heap? So the stack stores things that functions push on there when they're called and remove when they return. The heap stores things like malloc and new, where the thing might live for longer than a particular function call. So those are things you just can't put on the stack because you want to restore the stack back where it was when your function returns. And that means, like, if you want to put a string somewhere, it can't, and have it survive after the function returns, you can't put it in the stack. Any other questions? So I mentioned the sort of global variables and sort of our machine code. And this portion of our program memory is copied from our executable file. When we build a program with our C compiler, this is what is actually being stored on disk. And this is copied when the program starts into this part of memory. All the other stuff we set up each time we run the program, and it's made from scratch. You know, we write to the stack because our functions add things to the stack. We have code that does that. But this stuff, we don't have code that puts our machine code in memory that we write. Someone else writes that, and that copies it from disk. And also our global variables have some initial values. Those are also stored in our executable and copied into memory. So basically, the simplest version of what an executable is, it's more complicated in practice, is that it's just literally the data you put in memory there. We have all these steps you may or may not remember for producing an executable. So who here has heard of, at some point, object files? Okay, so we have three phases, one of which is object file. So when we take your C program, first, the compiler converts it to assembly, which you've seen before in 2150. And then that assembly file gets converted to an object file. And the object file is the machine code from the assembly, but it's not actually ready to be loaded into memory yet. So something's missing. And we'll talk a bit about what might be missing. And then we have linking, where we take one or more object files and turn that into an executable. So we take that machine code and that not quite ready form and build the thing that's actually ready to load into memory. And usually, when you use a compiler, you probably skip some steps. So for example, GCC minus C produces an object file. It doesn't seem to produce an assembly file, but internally, there is an assembly produced. You just don't see it. It's in a temporary file or just stored in memory. But all the steps still happen. And similarly, you may have used the C compiler to produce an executable directly. And what happens internally is that still the assembly and the object file is produced. It's just made in a temporary file that you don't see. Like, all the steps always happen every time we produce a program. So let's look at sort of what actually happens in each of these steps in some more detail. Okay, so our first step is going to be taking our C file. Here's our hello world in plain C. That's why I'm not using C out, because I don't want to show you what the assembly looks like for that. And our first step is to convert this to assembly. So in this case, this is fairly straightforward. We're going to need to have our assembly include all the instructions, so we allocate some space on the stack. As it turns out, there's a reason for that related to the calling convention, that this is what an actual compiler generates. We place the string in the register where putS expects its argument, which per the calling convention, which maybe you remember from 2150, is RDI. And then we call putS. And then putS returns, and we clear out our return value to return 0, with, in this case, the XOR instruction, and actually return. And we also specify in the assembly file the string constant hello world, and we say it's in the data section, rather than the text section, which is the convention for that's where the machine code is. So any questions on this assembly translation? Don't know how much you've dealt with sort of the extra stuff compilers add. Yeah?
What did you say about text versus data?
So the text part is where the code actually, machine code actually is. The data part is where things like global variables are. So on our picture from earlier, the the text part is part of this code, probably, code plus constants part, whereas the data part is going to be part of this writable data. So it's a different part of the memory, which is why we need to tell them the assembly file where it's going to end up. Okay, so any other questions about this? So assembly translation? Make sense? So our next step is going to be to write this down as machine code. So this is what our assembler does. So we produce an object file which contains a representation of this as machine code. So the simple thing is, okay, first we just take all these instructions, convert them to machine code, I'm going to tell you that that's the real x86 machine code. I wouldn't expect you to be able to figure that out. That's what it is. So am I done? Is there anything I am missing here? There probably is if I'm asking. Yeah. So we need to link everything together. So, but I'm not even, this is not even enough for the object file. But thinking about linking is the right thing because our linker is missing some things in this object file that are in the assembly file that it's going to need. So what are some examples of those things? Doesn't go, sorry? S? Oh, so put s, yeah. So we didn't tell it about put s. Put s is clearly not the machine code for these instructions. How do we know what we're calling? How does it know that we're calling put s? So it's not clear that we've done that. There's something else we're missing? Yeah. Yeah, so we better have the string, even though it's not part of the machine code, even though our assembler is mostly about making the machine code, we also need to place the string there. So we're going to also write down our data segment with the string data. And I note, as a side note, I'm showing this as hexadecimal. I'm showing that so you can read it. It's going to be not stored that way in the file. It's going to be stored in something more compact, probably the direct, you know, byte by byte of the machine code and the string. Okay. And so we have some other questions about, so one thing mentioned was, you know, put s, things like that. So I've showed you sort of corresponding parts of the assembly file in that. So you can see of the machine code, because I'm not going to expect you to know what x86 machine code looks like. And you can see first, here, this blue section here, that's the machine code part for the address of the string. And does it look right? Probably not. It's all zeros. That's probably not where the string is in memory. And similarly, we have the, in pink here, we have the address of put s in the machine code. And that also doesn't look right. So what we do when we produce an object file is when we don't know where things are going to end up being, we don't know exactly where that writable data part of memory is going to be, so we can't say what the string's address is yet. We don't know where putS is because it's not specified anywhere. The linker is going to take care of that. So we have these placeholders. So we could translate the subtract instruction correctly because we know everything we need to know for that. But for the other things, we just put in a blank and made up, you know, an address, in this case all zeros, because we don't know yet. And because we did that, the assembler needs to keep some extra information. And these are called relocations, that we put in this bogus address, and later on, we're going to relocate that bogus address to the real address. And to do that, we have to write down where did we make these substitutions. So we say 6 bytes into the machine code for the text segment here, for the where our move instruction is, I put an address that needs to end up being the beginning of my data segment, wherever that ends up being in memory. We also say 10 bytes into the machine code here, I put it up in an address that needs to be replaced with wherever putS actually is. Please figure that out for me. Okay, and right. And we have another thing we need to put in, which is we have main here, and eventually something needs to know to start at main. So we better actually write down where main is. We can't, it could have not been at the beginning of the text segment, so we need to write that down. And so that's called a symbol table. Main is a symbol, it's a name. And that's another part of our object file. So any questions about any of these components of the object file? So why we might need each of them? Yeah.
Can you explain explain the main again? Is that just where the file started?
So the question is, can I explain the main? Is this where the file starting? So this main here, because we have this label main, which is a function, we need to know where that function is when another file needs it. So that's just reflecting that I put this label in the assembly. That's what the reason we have it there. So if we put main elsewhere, it would be point to a different location. Other questions? Yeah.
Just to clarify, so the simple table is for like the headers like that?
For the labels, yeah. It's where we write down the labels. Yeah. So other files, when we link things together, can find out where they are. So for example, there's another file which has a simple table entry for putis somewhere.
Is that like what would actually print the file?
So the question is, for under relocations, is that sort of English I have there what would be in the file? So it wouldn't be written in English like that. But there's some binary encoding which you can interpret very straightforwardly in like this. Like it is actually specified as this many bytes after the beginning of the machine code, this symbol name. But it's a little, instead of more compact and easier to parse and code it. And this varies between platforms, which is another reason that this slide isn't as specific as it could be. Yeah?
Is there a certain reason why the relocation
is specifying 6 and 10? So is there a reason, why are the relocations specifying byte 6 and byte 10 is the question. And this is because they're just based on where in the machine code things happen to be, and I may have miscounted bytes. But it's just wherever in the machine code we did something is where the relocation is. I think they're in the middle of the thing, but usually you'd specify the first byte. If we're starting at one, I think they're right. Yeah. So that's saying that this L string reference here, it should point to here. That's by the beginning of the data segment. And you see our color coding, that's the first character of the string. That's how we get that address into the machine code. So we end up putting the address of the string in RDI when we run it. So, other questions about this?
I just still don't understand why else, like how that else string has anything to do with, I don't understand like the relationship between putting that and then the relocation.
So the problem is that we don't know. Is that we don't know exactly where the writable data part and where coding constants are going to end up in memory. And we need to put an address there. So because we don't actually know the address, we can't write down the address in the object file. Because it depends how our executable is made where that string is going to end up. So the relocation exists to act as a placeholder for when we eventually figure out, depending on how we link our executable, where that string is. Is that clearer?
Yeah.
And maybe it will be clearer with the next step. So our next step is that
But if you know where that string is when you're linking, then you just copy it into the object file and call it A, instead of having to know that at runtime?
If I know where the string is in memory?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if I knew where the string was, I could just not put zeros there and put the address of the string. So almost never will we actually know where things are when we're producing object files. And this is not so obvious from our past picture because it looks like from the diagram I showed you that, hey, code always starts at the same place. So, and data starts at the same place, so maybe I can just figure that out. But the problem is that we almost never make an executable with just one file. So for example, in this case, we need puts. So we're going to include another object file that we didn't write, which includes puts. So maybe standard io.o has the assembly machine code for puts, and that's going to be, you know, how we're going to figure out where puts is to fill in those zeros we have in the object file when we produce our executable.
So if you have the machine code for puts, we can just copy that machine code into this object file and then not do anything?
You could, but our assembler only looks at the assembly file. Because we want to have multiple implementations of puts. So the question is, why don't we just copy the machine code for puts in the object file production process? Okay, so our assembler is going to work a file at a time, so we can have different versions of puts depending on, you know, what version of the OS you have and things like that. So when we produce our executable, what we're going to do is we're going to take a bunch of object files and we're going to write down the machine code and the data in them from all the object files that are making up our executable and put them together. And then we're going to replace all the relocations with actual addresses. And that's going to help us, that's going to make it so we can load this into memory. And because we might be linking in a different thing, standard io.o, different times, we don't actually know where anything really ends up in memory. We might put standard io.o before or after main in memory. We don't know that yet, so we don't know where anything is in memory when producing this first object file. So it's the second linking step where we actually fill in all those blanks and know where everything is when we actually decide which object file goes where in the executable. Where do I put the machine code from standard io.o? Where do I put the machine code from hello.o, etc.? Yeah.
Will the memory address of standard IO change over time, or is it always going to be there?
So the question is, does the memory address of standard IO.o change over time? So with different versions of standard IO.o, it's going to change. Definitely, right? You just, you know, if the length of puts change, puts and the functions around it change, exactly where it is in memory probably is going to change. And in practice, different executables will often have libraries in different places, just because we took the same object files, but, you know, in a different order, or we had more object files and before it, and we just allocate them one after the other, and sometimes we get up to, you know, 10,000 bytes, sometimes we get up to 20,000 bytes, so we use different ranges of addresses. So it is the case that you could imagine, like, saying that I don't want to do this sort of linking, I'm going to always make puts be at a particular address, and a few systems do things kind of like that, but it's not very common. And it's not the normal linking process you're used to. So usually it's decided every time we make an executable, where am I going to put everything? Yeah. So this is what is standard io.o is the question. So this is a file provided by our compiler, which includes the machine code for puts. It might not be the real name of it, but there's something like that on real systems. Yeah?
Does this linking process happen in file time or runtime?
So the question is, when does this linking happen? So most simplistically, it happens at compile time, that we have these three steps, linking is the last. So in practice, there's something called dynamic linking. So some linking happens at compile time, and some additional linking happens at runtime. I'm not describing dynamic linking here, partly to keep things simpler, and partly because it uses a slightly different mechanism. It's very similar to this, but for speed, they do things a little bit differently than what I'm showing on this slide. So they've made, in particular, they try to do less, typically try to do less changing things in the machine code. But I'm not going to talk about that in this course. You can ask me in office hours or something. But there's something like this, which is also done at runtime most of the time. But always a large part of it happens at the time we produce the executable. Any other questions? Okay, in that case, a question. So here's some C code. Let's say I compile and link this. Which files are going to contain the memory address of say hello? So I want you to figure out what this is and check with your neighbor to make sure you agree on what the answer is. And this is assuming everything's name starts with main. There's no tricks like that. Okay. Anyone want to volunteer an answer? Okay. Or actually, it's first. Okay. So some people are ready, but let's not do that. Actually, let's do a show of hands. So who thinks the answer includes A? How about includes B? Some raises of hands. C? Okay, most people. Who thinks it's B and C? Or A, B, and C? A, B, and C? Okay. And who thinks it's none of those? Like the combination is none of those. Okay. So does someone who think, so someone want to explain the answer they think they have? So everyone seems to agree it's in main.exe. So why is it in main.exe? Let's start with that. Or almost everyone, not everyone, I'm sure. Yeah. So that's when we know where it is. Why is the address going to appear in the executable file rather than just knowing where it is?
Because when you're creating the executable file, it's linked in, because now you can actually put stuff in
memory. So I agree that we definitely know what the memory address is, and that you can like figure out the memory address from main.exe. I agree with that. The question's asking, does it contain it? Like, is it in the file itself? So yes, I agree. That seems like a reasonable thing to think. So why?
Because since you know where it is, you can put it in the file.
So we can put it in the file. So why would it be in the file though?
Because when you're going to execute it, you want to know where it is to actually execute.
Okay. Why do we need to know where the say hello is?
Because you need to put it. So we need to
put it. So where? Why do we need to put it in? Is the question? Yeah. Yes, and why would it have been? Why would it, we need to have put it in there? Like,
because you need. I guess what I'm thinking is there wouldn't be, by the time it gets to the executable, it wouldn't be a memory address anymore. It would be essentially the actual code of say hello.
Okay.
That is replaced with the memory address that was there.
Okay, so we have the actual code of say hello at that memory store, which we placed at that memory address. But that isn't the memory address itself. Yeah. But yeah, so the key thing, which is subtle, is that it's called in main. So the straightforward translation of this to assembly has a call instruction. And that machine code instruction needs to have the address. So we don't necessarily need to write down the address, like we know what it is, but we don't need to write it down for any other reason, except we actually need to call it. Like the actual machine code needs to call it, so it needs to specify what that address is in memory when it's running. So that's how we know it's in main, and it's in main because it's called, not just because it's there. Like we could just, it's, we know it's loaded there, but that doesn't mean we wrote down the number it gets loaded at. We did write it down because we need it for the call instruction. Yes?
Is the executable, is that in assembly or machine?
So this executable, that's all, that's machine code. That's exactly what we load into the memory. So other, yeah?
Is the file name relevant here, or could it be named anything?
It could be named anything. Only the extension is relevant. Yeah. Yeah, only the extension is relevant. I use dot, this question is does the file name .exe matter? I use .exe just for extra clarity, that it's an executable and not something else. Okay, so and there seems to be mixed opinions about whether the address was in the object file. So does someone want to argue for or against why there should the address of say hello should be in the object file? Yeah. Okay, so you think the address is going to be in the symbol table. And it's true. It's definitely true that we just said that we need to write down the address in the symbol table of all the labels we have. And that's going to be a label because it's something we call. So it's going to appear in the symbol table. We're going to write down, you know, where do we find the machine code that I wrote in this object file for that say hello function. But that address, and this is a very subtle thing about the question I asked, which maybe is unfair, is not the memory address. In this case, it's the address, it's the location in this file, is not where things actually end up in memory. So it's true that we have some form of the location of say hellos in the object file, but we don't actually have the real memory address yet. And that's just because we don't know it yet, because we don't know how much stuff from standard io.io and other object files we're going to put in our executable yet, so we can't know the address. So it can't be what we put in the symbol table. Instead, we have to put something that only cares about this object file. Okay. And as for main.s, so a few people thought that it was in main.s, and we have the same sort of issue. We do have something that substitutes for the address in main.s, which is the label. The label is probably just say hello. It says call say hello. But the label is not the memory address yet. That happens much later. So any questions about this example? Yeah.
So when it converts from all the objects that you need for the file, what actually happens in terms of determining memory? Like, do you have a specific allocation of this block is for this program, and then it decides where in memory to slide that? Or
so the question is, how does the linker decide where in memory its collection of object files go? So the general idea is that we have this program layout, and we know what the starting address of the code is. And the linker just says, I need to put this much stuff for this object file, and it increments that and says, it goes in that range. And then it says, the next stuff after that is for this, and it just remembers what the range is. It keeps count starting with this fixed address by convention. Does that make sense? So typically, yeah, memory addresses are relative to some starting point. I'm giving the simplest way a linker could work. The linker might be able to do fancier things if it wants. But assuming the whatever loads this file into memory can support it. Yeah?
Does it decide how many assembly files?
So the question is, do we decide the memory address in the assembly file? No.
I mean, does it decide the where to locate?
So the question is, where do we make this decision about this 400,000 hex address, right? So this decision is typically made by convention for an operating system. And in practice, you can make a different decision by passing some arguments to the linker. You almost will never do this, but that is usually possible. And there's something in the executable file which says, hey, operating system, when you run this, load this into memory at this address. That varies between OSs, which is one reason I didn't show it. It varies exactly how that works or whether that's even possible. Okay. Any other questions about this? Yeah. So what happens is we have this placeholder here. So this is a move instruction, for example. And we don't know the address of the string yet, so we just put zeros. And we copy this machine code with this placeholder into the executable. And where those zeros were, we actually put the memory address, which in this case is going to be 40202A7 in the move instruction. And there's something similar that happens with the call instruction. I'm not actually really showing machine code here to keep things more understandable, because the address is written in a different way. But this is the basic idea, is that we just literally have zeros that we replace with whatever we want. But otherwise, we're just copying byte by byte from the object file. There's no other processing. The linker does not actually know assembly. Okay, so a second question. Now this is, so we asked about the memory address of, say hello, how about the string, the literal string, hello world? Which files is that in? And you can check with your neighbor, see if you agree. So who thinks it's in the assembly file? Okay. Who thinks it's in the object file? Who thinks it's in the executable file? Who thinks so, which gives, so how many people think A and B, B and C? A, B, and C? Something else? Some other combination between those three? Like none of them? Okay. So, like to get to a little more. So the string is clearly in this C file. And if we look at the assembly file I showed you being produced, it's going to be in the assembly file. Now, we have to put it somewhere. It needs to end up in the executable. And we aren't giving the next steps of the producing our executable any other file. So it better be in the object file, because there's no other way for the information to get there. And there's no reason for it not to be as the literal string. There's not some other way to encode it that makes any sense. Though I wouldn't fault you for thinking maybe the compiler doesn't do that. And it wouldn't be ridiculous not to. But probably it's actually a literal string. Maybe the compiler does something clever for some reason. And in our object file, we're just writing down like binary. And the most straightforward way to write down a string is just the literal ASCII bytes. So it's probably going to be those literal bytes. I showed them as hex here because I'm showing machine code. I want to emphasize that they're bytes. But if you open up an object file in a text editor, you will probably see strings and then garbage characters, which are like machine code that doesn't display as ASCII. And the same thing's gonna be true of the executable. In memory, we probably want those ASCII characters. And we're copying the executable into memory directly, so it should be in the executable as those ASCII characters. Does that make sense?
So it's in all three?
So it's in all three, typically, yeah. So maybe I said the compiler could be clever and encode it in some other way, or it could generate some weird machine code where it like puts the, there's some weird assembly code where it like makes the string out of two pieces, but most straightforwardly, it's in all three. Yeah.
So it's in all three, but in different forms?
It's in all three, and it's literally the ASCII bytes, just for different reasons. So in the assembly file, it's the ASCII bytes because that capital H is an ASCII capital H. And the object code, it's the ASCII bytes because there's a bunch of bytes that get copied into the executable, and they're going to be the ASCII bytes. There's no reason to use something more complicated. And in the executable, we want the ASCII bytes in memory, so they're going to be ASCII bytes in the executable. So there's different things around it, but it's going to be the same bytes. Yeah?
The placeholder bytes in hello.o, are those intended to be replaced with a memory address or the literal string value?
It's intended to replace with a memory address. We'll talk about assembly syntax later, and which will explain how you could know that. Because I agree it's not obvious from the assembly, am I putting the string in the register, or the address of the string in the register or not, or whatever. Okay.
Sorry to explain, sorry, but I'm a little confused about how, like, in between the object file and the executable, linker, reads the locations of where the symbols are in memory.
So the question is, how does the linker know where the symbols are in memory? So what the linker is going to do is it's going to choose an order for the object files, and it's going to say copy, take, and it's going to assign addresses to every byte of the machine code in order from each object file. So once it's done that, then it knows how to take these placeholders, which say the address of puts, it looks it up in the symbol table, and it knows, okay, I know what byte I just assigned to that because I know where I put each object file in memory. That makes sense? I know, probably. Still clear. Okay. Yeah?
So for the hello assembly code, is it an ASCII or because what you wrote down in data, it looks like it's
good. So for all these, I'm showing hexadecimal, but that's not the way the object file is most likely written because that's not a very efficient way. Right, you wouldn't like to have your compiler produce object files which are like two or three times larger than they need to be. Especially like if you're compiling Firefox, you know, which has probably gigabytes of object files. Yeah?
Is it safe to assume that any crucial information would be in the executable?
So the question is it safe to assume any crucial information is in the executable? The executable contains anything which ends up in memory. So, which probably means basically yes. So in some form, right? So if it's in memory, when the program starts, it's in the executable. Okay, any other questions about this before we move on to talking about C, which I expected to get to earlier, but okay. Okay, so let's talk about C. So here are data types in C. And as I mentioned earlier when we asked about endianness, C and C++ vary what they do between machines. I'm sorry, that's how it works. So they're not the same across different machines. That's the decision the language designers made. For this course, we'll be using machines where these are the sizes. We have chars, which are 1-byte integers. Yes, they are integers. Shorts, which are 2-byte integers, ints, which are 4-byte integers, longs, which are 8-byte integers. We have floats and doubles, which you've probably used before, and we also have pointers. Pointers, for machines we'll use this course, are always 8 bytes, no matter what kind of pointer they are. So those are our data types. You notice that there's a data type missing here. So from C++, and you may be used to bool. From Java, you may be used to Boolean. In C, this does not exist. There is no Boolean type. Yes? Sure. Looking. So since there's no Boolean type, we need some sort, one of these types, or some other type I didn't tell you about, needs to represent like the result of equality. C has chosen to use ints. So the result of x equals equals 4 is an int. It's 1 if it's true, 0 if it's false. And this is true for everything which you would think of as returning a Boolean. In C, it returns an int, 1 if true, 0 if false. So 0 isn't, so 0 and 1, you might think that that's true and false. So for false values, 0 is the only false value in C, including no pointer. So no pointers are 0 cast to a pointer, and those are false. So those are the false values in C. All other values in C are true. All of them. So let's take our logical operators we're all familiar with. So as I said, they return 0 or 1. I might need extra parentheses on this. Sorry. I probably should have extra parentheses here. So sorry. Yeah. So if you... So these should have extra parentheses in. But other than that, because I don't know precedence, apparently. But this is how logical operators work in C, is that all these other values are false, including the empty string are true. So the empty string is true, because it's not 0. And negative 1 is true, because it's not 0. OK? Any questions about this? And all our Boolean logical operators, so exclamation point to negate, you know, take the opposite of a value, and or all work this way. They all return 0 and 1, but they interpret their values as false if they're 0, true otherwise. There's no errors. It's just false or true. Any questions about this? And speaking of these logical operators, logical operators do something that you may find a little unintuitive that you probably didn't have mentioned in 2150 or any prior course as discovered, is that they are short-circuiting. So looking at this code, you'd expect, because I have this function 0 and 1, it looks like, most straightforwardly maybe, that 0 is called twice and 1 is called twice, and you would expect 0 to be printed out twice and 1 to be printed out twice, but that's not what happens. So why is this happening here? What? Yeah. Yeah, so our C compiler is going to take a shortcut. So we're going to look at 0 in this case. 0 is false, so we don't actually know whether this OR is going to be false or true. If you look at our truth table here, there's two possibilities. They're different. So in this case, we actually execute the 1. But 1 is true. And when we look at this truth table, oh, we already know that the result is true. So we finish. So you might think of this as an optimization. It is not, this is required for C compilers to do. It is not optional. It is not just to speed things up. They cannot in this call 0 in that second printf. It is not allowed. Yes?
So I think in C++, you can force the evaluation of code with a single
So we'll talk about, so the question is, can you force the evaluation of both with a different operator? So there is an operator with a single OR, but it is not an operator you should use as a substitute for logical purposes. We will talk about it later in the semester. So any questions on the short circuiting? Okay, so I'm mentioning this so you don't get surprised when things don't get run later in the semester. So it also happens with AND. So in this case, 0 and 1. When we see 0, we look at this truth table and we know, oh, we don't need to run 1. And we don't run it, and the C compiler is required not to do that. Because we already know the answer is going to be 0, we don't need to keep going. This also means we always go from left to right in logical operator, these logical operators. Okay. Any questions on short-circuiting operators? Okay. So let's move on to a more weighty topic, which is strings. So strings in C, we don't have a string class. And apparently I misaligned my slide when I was editing it. But we don't have a string class. So strings are pointers to characters. So characters are integers that have an ASCII value. A string is a pointer to one of them, which is followed in memory by the other characters of the string, and then followed by a zero, which is represented as a character constant with backslash zero. That's just the number zero as a character. So if we have this code, then we have hello, the variable which is stored on the stack or in a register, is a pointer to the character capital H, which is followed in memory by an E, by an L, and so on. Any questions on this? Yeah.
So when it hits that zero, it knows that the string is in it. What if you want to print the character?
So the question is, so something knows the string is ended when we hit that zero. What if I want to print a literal, the character represented by the number zero in ASCII? So this is just up to what functions you're using that interpret the pointer. So things like puts expect to look for a zero. There are other functions which don't do that. But it is entirely about how you're, how whatever you pass the pointer uses it. Yeah. So the question is, are strings always read-only? So string constants like this are read-only. There are other cases where they won't be. We will probably have an example tomorrow. You can put it in an array and copy it there, then it's not read-only, for example. Okay. So C and C++ have something called pointer arithmetic. So if we have hello, our string, we can it's a pointer to a character. We can modify that pointer to point to things adjacent to it in memory. So if I have a pointer to the capital H, I can add 5 to it and get a pointer to the space after the hello. And this is actual supported C syntax that works. And in assembly, this is just adding 5 to the value in the register. That's the number of the pointer. And you can take this pointer you compute and dereference it with the star operator, and you get back the character at that location in memory. And you can also do the same thing with the brackets operator. In fact, this is literally always the same in C. This is not true in C++, but in C, this is literally always the same. So what our array indexing operator in C does is it treats something as a pointer, adds the number of the index to it, and dereferences it. So that makes sense when the thing that the foo we have is a pointer, but it also works when it's an array, when it's really an array. And the way that happens is that arrays, if they aren't arrays, decay into pointers. So C will churn an array that you try to use like a pointer, and this operator counts, or adding to it counts, into a pointer to the first element of the array. So any questions on this? Okay, so I guess we probably have just enough time for this. Yeah, so here's an exercise. Figure out what the final value of foo is, given what I told you about how the referencing works. And check with your neighbor, see if you agree. You might want to write things down. That's how I would do this, but I see no one does that. Okay, who has an answer? Not many people. Okay, give people another minute or so. Who thinks the answer is A? Who thinks it's B? Who thinks it's C? Who thinks it's D? Who thinks it's something else or it crashes? Who has no idea? Okay, so C is actually right. This does not crash, I believe. So let's go through a brief overview here. So this is what foo looks like. This syntax is one way you can make a string not be in read-only memory. Because I'm making an array and putting the string into it. I'm not making a pointer to some constant. So we have foo that's stored on the stack in this case, which contains initially F00 and /0, the zero ASCII character. Yes? Yes. The question is, do I have to explicitly make space for the /0? If you use 3, there won't be space. If you don't specify any number between the brackets, the compiler will figure out 4. I didn't do that just to make this example clearer about what the size of the array was. Yes?
So if you didn't make it 3, what
would happen? What would happen if you made it 3 is the question. If you made it 3, the 0 just wouldn't be stored. Okay. So our first step is that pointer. Okay, so that's what the problem is. So this disagrees with that, so there's no star there. The first step is that pointer is set to foo, and this is decays. So pointer points to the first element of the array, then we set that to B, by dereferencing it. So we set the first element of the array to B using this pointer to that element. Then we set the pointer to point to the second O by adding 2 to it and setting the pointer equal to the result of that addition. Then we use the other syntax, which remember is the same thing as star pointer plus x, or 0 in this case. So it's the same as star pointer, which is better style, what you should do, not what this example shows, and set that to z. And then we use the sort of more confusing syntax to do the same thing, to start, take the array foo, go one element into it, dereference that, and change an element, something. Yeah. So that's all I have for today. So quiz after, the quiz this evening, and before next week.